I'm Josh Hammer.
I'm Emily Jashinsky.
I'm Ben Weingarten.
And I'm Rachel Bovard.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common sense and common good meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. So we got another great show for you today. We're going to tee it off with Rachel talking about yet another Rachel big tech late issue. This time Parler is returning to the Apple iOS app store. Will Google and Amazon follow suit? We're going to talk next about court packing. We'll talk after that about a brave new anti-racist school that was flagged by Barry Weiss's Substack. And we're going to cap it off with Ben kind of breaking down the latest of the shenanigans from none other than Ibram X. Kendi. But let's dive right in. Rachel, what's going on with Parler and Apple?
Well, it's another day that ends with Y. So there's another big tech story to talk about. And this time, as Josh referenced, it's good news actually on the front of Parler, which, as you may recall, was collectively nuked from the marketplace by Apple's App Store, Google Play, which is Google's App Store, and Amazon Web Services, almost all within 24 hours of each other, following January 6th, under the guise of having contributed and being an organizing, have been organizing platform for, you know, everything that happened on January 6th. Now, it came out in the months following that this was an obviously pretextual excuse by these platforms who were effectively, you know, joining forces to kneecap a competitor. We saw this with how the Department of Justice, in its charging documents against the participants of January 6th, in those charging documents, they cited posts on Facebook, posts on YouTube, and posts on Instagram owned by Facebook by orders of magnitude more than they cited posts on Parler. So that debunked the whole argument that Parler was the hub of the January 6th, quote unquote, insurrection. That was transparently just not the case. But more than that, I think it exposed the hypocrisy of these, you know, major outlets by saying, oh, you banned Parler under the pretext that they were a hotspot for organizing. But we know now that more of that organizing was done on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram, all of which remain untouched, you know, in the app stores themselves, as well as, you know, access to Amazon Web Services, the different functions of that as well. It also came out that Parler was actively moderating content. The claims were, oh, they don't have content moderation in place to deal with this violent rhetoric, when in fact they were moderating and they were passing along troubling posts to the FBI. So over time, you know, the excuses fell apart, added to which Senator Mike Lee and Congressman Ken Buck sent a letter to Apple in where they asked for a host of information specifically about whether or not these platforms communicated with each other. If they did, what did these communications say? Asked for evidence of, you know, where Parler was violating policies, but these other platforms were not. And I think, you know, it got to the point where Apple in particular could no longer claim the moral high ground here. And, you know, we're recording this on a Tuesday. It's Tuesday. And tomorrow, Wednesday, Apple will be appearing before the antitrust subcommittee in the Senate to talk about the role its App Store plays in the marketplace. And I think at that point they realized, because the guy testifying is actually Apple's head antitrust lawyer, realized he was going to be up against some very difficult headwinds if they didn't take action on this front. Now, it remains to be seen, I think, what Parler agreed to be let back in. I think they had to agree to some conditions, and I'm hopeful that they, you know, are not completely, you know, pulling Parler strings at this point, right? Because the problem I see with the dominance of these app stores primarily is that, again, we want free speech and a multiple offerings in the marketplace, but these app stores are effectively the only way you can reach a mainstream audience if you are an app. And you have Apple and Google saying, well, dance to our tune or we will not let you access what is effectively the entire market. This leads to a broader discussion of the role these app stores play, which will be discussed on Wednesday before the Senate subcommittee. And you're also seeing a lot of state action on this front. There's an ongoing dispute right now between Apple's App Store and Epic Games and Fortnite over the 30% surcharge Apple takes from anyone who sells through its platform. So it's able to offer its own services for a reduced price, but hike, you know, the cost of every other competitor. So again, this really just gets into the various aspects of the marketplace that are dominated by big tech. And I feel like every week there's a new nuance or a new story or a new abuse to talk about. But I think Parler is worth highlighting because I think for a lot of conservatives, a lot of the free market conservatives, what happened to it was the Rubicon. When members of Congress saw this happening, it was like, okay, there is no more debating about the market power of these companies. It is now proven. So I'm curious how long Parler will last in the app before Apple decides to nuke it again. It may be that they just bought themselves a reprieve for the next month or so while they had to face, you know, Senate oversight, and then they may be effectively banned again. But Parler, I think, is a very important proxy for the larger nature of this debate, which is about not only the market power of these platforms, but how that market power is shaping free speech and expression in downstream of independent thought and, again, voter behavior, which is what these platforms control in sum. So I don't know if anybody has additional thoughts about kind of how this went down and the future for Parler.
I think the Rubicon analogy really kind of resonates and hits home with me. From my perspective, when Google, Amazon, and Apple colluded, and it seemed like a naked kind of Sherman-Clayton Antitrust Act violation style collusion, when they colluded to effectively nuke Parler, that was the day back in January that the build your own Google talking point, I think, for a lot of people died. So the Rubicon talking point really, I think, resonates and makes a lot of sense. Let's focus for a second on the positives here, because it is kind of a rare, at least for a short-term kind of temporary basis. So it's a rare positive kind of development in the space of big tech. Huge credit, of course, to Congressman Ken Buck, Senator Mike Lee. I'm happy that Rachel both referenced them. On a very personal note, I'm kind of proud of Senator Lee in particular. I was a law clerk for him on the antitrust subcommittee years ago, back when it was not obvious to me that Senator Lee, could have possibly opposed private action on kind of standard kind of laissez-faire, hands-off ground. So I think his kind of evolution of thought on this is telling in a lot of ways about kind of the direction of the movement, especially as it pertains to big tech and the threats that big tech poses to everything that we talk about on the show on a seemingly weekly basis. So good for Congressman Buck and good for Senator Lee. But on the other hand, you know, as Rachel said, this story is not necessarily about Parler, right? Obviously, this agreement could be nuked tomorrow or next week. I mean, who knows what's going to happen with Google and the Android App Store. I think back, there was a really fabulous essay earlier this week, if I can just highlight it, that Ryan Anderson, the new president of EPBC, co-authored with a law professor, I believe by the name of Adam McLeod. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. It was a really long essay in National Review, very much kind of playing off Justice Thomas's concurrence that we talked about, I guess it was two episodes ago, in his recent kind of 230 common carrier case, just trying to basically say that people on the so-called hard right, if that's kind of like the libertarian right, I guess, if we can call it that these days, and the so-called hard left, are both wrong for their own reasons to oppose kind of common carrier regulation, public accommodation status under the Civil Rights Act kind of statutory framework. I really, 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 to say something that we've said in previous podcasts, I really think that's where this is ultimately headed. I really think that if I had to make a guess here, I would probably predict that it'll be kind of RNC platform, literally on the platform in 2024, that Google, Amazon, Facebook should be regulated like common carriers. So I think that's where this is headed. So to an extent, it's not about Parler, but to the extent that it is about Parler, kudos to Congressman Buck, kudos to Senator Lee. Great for Parler, great for consumers. As you said, Rachel, it was all pretextual. There was nothing that Parler was doing vis-a-vis January 6th that the other platforms weren't doing, oftentimes even more egregiously. So this was very clearly kind of an ad hominem collusive assault against Parler. And at least in the short term, it's a great story that we should celebrate, I think.
I have kind of a cynical and an optimistic take on this. The cynical perspective is that this was such a glaring example of the anti-competitive behavior of these companies that they realized as there was more distance January 6th, they realized that it would probably be wise to quietly concede on it, knowing that it would probably only get a lot of play in conservative media, because it does take away one of the biggest counter arguments in that Twitter and Parler is the closest like one-to-one example we have of competitors right now, right? Like, we don't have Facebook and MySpace anymore. And so the Twitter Parler comparison is as close to apples as we can possibly get. And so the way that other companies acted in concert to harm parlor was just such an obvious glaring example that I think, you know, they realize it's in their own best interest to avoid further attacks on the anti-competitive basis, to quietly concede on this as the weeks passed from January 6th and the decision sort of fell out of the news cycle. And that's my cynical take, because I do think that's probably, like, this was a battle they realized was not worth fighting from their perspective, that in the long run, it would actually be better to cede some ground here. I think also on an optimistic note, there's them recognizing that is a really big deal, right? Like, them recognizing it means that they are responsive to pressures. And we've seen, you know, like, Josh Hawley take some steps with legislation that I don't think he actually has ever, this is not everything he introduced, but he has introduced some things that I don't think he has actually ever intended to become law so much as he intends it to sort of put the fear of God into these Silicon Valley executives and saying, listen, when you are overreaching, the government is here and can step in, and the political will to do that exists. And so on an optimistic note, it's possible that this represents the responsiveness in Silicon Valley to these pressure campaigns that are coming from both the right and the left. So cynically, do I think they tried to cede some ground here? Yes. Optimistically, it's good that they realized that it was in their best interest to do that.
Yeah, just following up on the whole cynicism aspect of all of this, the real question is why? Why did Apple ultimately relent? And I think that Rachel's suggestion that this is about fear over potential regulatory pain that might be inflicted upon them or something more, and these other collusive big tech companies as well, I think it's good that they at least respect that maybe there are limits to their actions. But nevertheless, we can't underestimate the chilling effect of this, the precedent that was set, and ultimately, you know, yes, collusive, truly collusive anti-competitive behavior was shown here. And I think it is imperative to underscore again that this really did cross a Rubicon for conservatives and hopefully some libertarians as well. And so that's a very beneficial kind of perverse silver lining to come of this. Nevertheless, again, the process at minimum was the punishment here. And so who is going to try to go up against any of these big tech companies going forward to have a truly free and open platform? You know, there are a handful of people out there. We'll see what ultimately happens with Substack, for example, as they get assaulted from the leftist press and probably big tech ultimately as well, and politicians for that matter. So the war on free speech continues, and we're just seeing it in the big tech realm here. But I think it's worth also underscoring one final point, which is that we're recording this during the week where the narrative about Officer Sicknick being killed by MAGA supporters has now fallen. And almost every single plank of the narrative around January 6th being an armed insurrection of white supremacists, Trump supporters seeking to topple the government, almost every single aspect of that narrative, the most egregious parts of it put forth, have all collapsed. But nevertheless, we've seen all of these knock-on effects in many other areas. And as I've argued here, and I argued in writing within a week after the January 6th riot, the riot was used as part of an information operation as an accelerant to purge any and all dissenters from the prevailing progressive orthodoxy. And free speech itself has been assaulted as a consequence of that January 6th data point. And we're still dealing with the consequences of it. We saw it when they tried to have a whole impeachment based upon a lax liberal incitement standard, which of course will have a chilling impact on dissenting speech. And of course, going after platforms writ large for having any speech that runs afoul of the party line in big tech and among our ruling class itself still speaks to the broader horrible outcomes as a consequence of what transpired on the 6th. But nevertheless, we'll take this win for however long it exists, and we'll look to what the devils and the details ultimately are in terms of Parler's agreement with these anti-free speech totalitarians.
Yeah, so I mean, speaking of totalitarianism, you know, which obviously is something that we get tossed around these days, but there is something that I would describe as genuinely totalitarian, at least within the theoretical confines of America's unique system of constitutional governance, which is court packing of the United States Supreme Court. Which harrowingly, distressingly, and unfortunately has never been more relevant, it appears, than in the year 2021. So before kind of getting back or diving in, I should say, into what is actually happening with respect to the court, I kind of want to take a step backwards here. So a very brief history lesson here. the size of the Supreme Court shifted for the country's first 7 or 8 decades. The Judiciary Act of 1869, you know, which is kind of in the aftermath of partisan rancor after the Civil War, solidified a 9-member court. There were 8 associate justices and 1 chief justice. That has stayed true from 1869 through the present day. It almost did not stay true in 1937, of course, when President FDR, who never saw a power grab that he didn't like, proposed his infamous court packing scheme. I don't remember the exact Orwellian kind of newspeak title of the bill, but he basically wanted to expand the court from 9 to 15 members to secure an immediate New Deal majority. At the time, it was decisively shot down in Congress. This is known kind of historically as the switch in time that saved 9, by which Justice Owen Roberts, who was a Hoover nominee, a Republican who was a New Deal skeptic, completely jurisprudentially shift sides basically on a dime in the West Coast Hotel case of 1937, thus kind of precluding FDR from trying to shove this down everyone's throats. But the key point here from a historical perspective is that FDR's own party, his Democrats, stood up to him in Congress. It was a Democrat-dominated Senate, and they shot this down mightily. Now, speaking about this in 2005, on the floor of the United States Senate, about Democrats standing up to defeat their own president's court packing plan, Joe Biden said, quote, "In an act of great courage, FDR's own party stood up against this institutional power grab. They did not agree with the judicial activism of the Supreme Court, but they believe that Roosevelt was wrong to seek to defy established traditions as a way of stopping that activism." Now, as I wrote in my column last week, and I'm going to read this full quote here because it is really that bone chilling. In this 2005 Senate floor speech, Joe Biden was actually underselling. He was underselling the extent to which FDR's own party affirmatively rebuked and repudiated his totalitarian power grab attempt. The Senate Judiciary Committee, which at the time, again, was dominated by Democrats, released this report with respect to FDR's court packing proposal, quote, "Let us of the 75th Congress, in words that will never be disregarded by any succeeding Congress, declare that we would rather have an independent court, a fearless court, a court that will dare to announce its honest opinions in what it believes to be the defense of the liberties of the people, than a court that out of fear or sense of obligation to the appointing power or factional passion approves any measure we may enact. We are not the judges of the judges. We are not above the Constitution." That's a real quote. I did not just make that up. FDR's own party said that. Nonetheless, as we all saw on the presidential campaign trail, Joe Biden refused to answer questions as to whether he would support court packing. He basically said over and over again, "You'll find out my real thoughts on this only after the election." Sure enough, very recently, we saw this unveiling of the so-called Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court of the United States. It is a commission of dozens of judges, former judges, law professors, political activists, et cetera. There are some nominal center-right people on there for sure, including a former professor and friend of mine, but it is heavily dominated by people center-left. And this commission is going to study and ultimately come up with recommendations about a lot of things pertaining to the court, including the, quote, membership and size of the court. Sure enough, less than a week after this commission was announced, Congressman Jerry Nadler of New York and Senator Ed Markey, Massachusetts, unveiled a bill, the Judiciary Act of 2021, that would affirmatively add 4 seats, which they say would be unpacking the Supreme Court. I guess words no longer have meanings. That is, by definition, packing the court. But here we are. Now, unless they nuke the filibuster, which, you know, we can kind of dive into, I guess, I suspect this bill is not going to pass. But it is telling that they are doing this. This is the closest we have come, whether it passes or not, in, you know, 85, 90 years since the New Deal, to a court packing actually taking place. So, you know, I have plenty of my own thoughts on this, but I'm curious what everyone makes of this. The fact that the Democrats are this kind of unvarnished, that they are willing to throw this out there. Court packing used to be a term that was anathema. The American people used to hear that and just bristle up. So I kind of wonder whether we've even lost our capacity to understand the radical nature of what they're doing here. But I'm happy to kick it open to the panel. Any reactions as to this transparent power grab attempt?
Well, I'll be brief because I haven't gone to law school yet, of course. It's really funny that you mentioned this bill, because the bill is such a good example that this is now a mainstream position in the Democratic Party. Like, it went from being anathema to being a mainstream position. I mean, that's legislation introduced by two mainstream Democrats. We're not talking about Rashida Tlaib. We're talking about who the media would like to be a mainstream Democrat. We're talking about, like, mainstream Democratic politicians who are introducing legislation to pack the court and then framing it as unpacking the court with this twisted logic that they expect the American people to believe or just not care enough to dig into, that they're actually unpacking it and they're just restoring balance. My last point that I just think has to be made is that this is coming from the party that cynically hyperventilated for 4 years about the destruction of norms, and their appetite for court packing shows exactly how hollow so much of that rhetoric actually was. They do not care about norms. They care less about norms than Republicans. Norms are something that are, you know, racist. They're relics of Jim Crow, like the filibuster. Norms are things that must be abolished to the left. And so when you have the hypocrisy of people like Jerry Nadler, people in the Democratic Party who spent literally 4 years, 5 years breathlessly hyperventilating about the Republican destruction of norms, and I see very little coverage in the media about the Democratic destruction of norms with this issue and other issues, it's just laughable, and it shows how cynical so much of their fear mongering has been for the last half decade.
Yeah, something I think that strikes me about this too, to kind of pick up on what Emily was saying, is that all these charges and everything that you think you just said, Josh, lays out the hypocrisy of this argument. You know, nothing more so to me than the image of Ed Markey, again, Senator Ed Markey, one of the sponsors of this legislation, what, 3 or 4 years ago, standing at a lectern with a poster in front that said, "We need 9, right? Going in for 9 members of the Supreme Court, now introducing, you know, without batting an eye, a bill to expand and pack the Supreme Court. But it almost goes to this point that they don't care about hypocrisy. They only care about accumulating power. We can throw hypocrisy, or, you know, charges of hypocrisy at them, norm destruction. They don't care because they know the media will front run for them. They know that they'll have the protection that they need. They know they can, again, redefine the English language to say, oh no, this isn't court packing. This is unpacking the court. Because what Donald Trump did was court packing, which, by the way, drives me absolutely bananas that some people have run with this narrative that filling existing judicial vacancies is court packing. No, it's just filling judicial vacancies. It's the Senate doing what the Senate's constitutionally obligated to do. So I fear the Democrat Party has been taken over by these people who aren't even shamed anymore. Shameless seems like too light of a word for it, but that's effectively what it is. They are no longer shamed by charges of hypocrisy because they keep going in for it regardless.
Let me just say that the thing that's kind of hilarious about this to me is that the whole driving force for packing the courts is the purported conservative majority. And yet, how often does the court actually come down on the right side of the most vital issues, as we've talked about, I think, before? So, but it goes to show you that for the left, they have to dominate everything. They can't lose 1% of the time. They have to win all the time. I wrote a column recently about the sort of jihad that was waged by Democrats on Michael Pack, who was supposed to run the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which oversees the Voice of America and a few other entities as well. And his nomination was held up for 3 years, almost to the end of the Trump presidency. And then he was fired on the first day, I think maybe within the first hour of the Biden presidency. And this is someone running an agency that most Americans have never even heard of before. Yet Democrats go scorched earth. They believe they have to control everything. And I actually saw a perverse silver lining again here, is that it's so clear that they are operating in bad faith, that they don't care about norms, rules, institutions, values, principles, constitutionality, history, et cetera, et cetera. All they care about is dominating. All they care about is power. And so if you work under that assumption, that ought to inform your plan for trying to combat them. And for too long, our side has not understood that. Increasingly, people do. And I think we go back to this almost every week, a running theme on this show. But it's very clear when the other side tells you who they are, you should believe them. And this is the perfect, perfect example of it. And ultimately, you know, the other part of this is the perversion of language with unpacking the Supreme Court. It just shows you how slippery and sophistic they are. And I think our side needs to do a better job of combating that as well. And we need to retake the language, quite frankly.
So really quick point, then we'll kick it over to Emily to talk about the latest on critical race theory and anti-racism in the context of education. I just want to underscore what Ben said towards the end there about the left kind of showing us who they are. And we do come back to this every single week about kind of the right, fighting with one hand tied behind its back and all of that. But in the specific context of judicial nominations, this is very, very, very important here. I mentioned Justice Owen Roberts, the switch in time that saved nine. Chief Justice Roberts, for his entire career now, for 16 years, has essentially been, the victim, I guess. We can call him the victim. That's fine. He's really not. We can call him kind of the target. That's more accurate. A target of a prolonged intimidation campaign. And he and people like him, maybe Justice Kavanaugh, maybe Justice Barrett, those kind of Justice Thomas obviously will never waver whatsoever. But people towards the more middle of the court, those more centrist-leaning Republican nominees, they are the true targets of this plan. They are trying to get them to shift. So I wonder, I query when, if ever, Republicans will actually understand that this is the kind of thing you have to take into account when you're selecting future jurors for the Supreme Court. Is you have to have a spine of steel. You have to be beyond strong in your convictions, and you have to be forthright and willing to not waver an inch when they come after you. But I could ramble on this for hours. Emily, why don't you steal the mic away from me before I do so, though?
Well, let's segue on the note that Ben sounded about the perverse silver lining, because I think there's something to be said for paying attention to the overreach that Democrats are engaged in. And this segue actually brings us to the overreach that the broader cultural left is engaged in. Barry Weiss often comes up on this show. She is among the sort of heterodox center-left thinkers who are doing a lot of work that people see as conservative now, because it's focused on just really analyzing and scrutinizing curriculum in our education system. You've seen this from people like Chris Rufo. Barry does a great job of it. She has published two pieces recently that have sort of pulled back the veil on the world of expensive coastal private education. She published an essay by a teacher at an expensive school, Paul Rossi, an essay from him talking about critical race theory at his school. He, by the way, is no longer in the classroom for the rest of the year because some students felt uncomfortable taking his class, which sort of proves his point, of course. And then there's the letter she published from Andrew Gutman, who is a parent at the Brearley School, who, again, this is a quote from the letter he sent to the school that Barry published last Friday. "If Brearley's administration was truly concerned about so-called equity, it would be discussing the cessation of admissions preferences for legacies, siblings, and those families with especially deep pockets. If the administration was genuinely serious about diversity, it would not insist on the indoctrination of its students and their families to a single mindset most reminiscent of the Chinese Cultural Revolution." He pulled his child out of that school, which, by the way, costs upwards, it's around $60,000 a year, somewhere at like the $55,000 a year mark, which is, I paid a lot for college. I didn't even pay that much for college. So it's just like a good example, I think, of how when you start seeing this, maybe it's the signs of optimism. Maybe it's sort of the spring that we've all been waiting for after this long winter in our education system. Maybe this is actually showing that what we have been going through for the past few years, dark as it may feel, is really just an adjustment period to that time when millennials sort of hit the workforce in droves and changed it. And maybe the pushback actually can make change when you have parents who send their kids to schools like this one that actually make you, I think, sign an anti-racist pledge even to get in. We've seen people like Cornel West come out in these things. This teacher is a math teacher. Paul Rossi is a math teacher at that school. I mean, these are just good examples of people who aren't traditionally going to align themselves with the right in critiquing their own schools, but they have sacrificed a lot. Not just are they criticizing the right, they're sacrificing their reputations and their careers and their lives, their personal reputations, to criticize the left on this. And that is no easy feat when you know you will have the entire media virtually and your community likely coming out against you. Guess, do you see this as optimistically as I do? Is this perhaps an example that the best is yet to come, or am I being too optimistic here?
Well, I think it's worth saying that Paul Rossi, this teacher, I believe, was recently relieved of his services, might have been the way that it was quoted. And so
He was. I can just quickly add, because I have the article pulled up here. This is from the New York Post. School spokesman Topher Nichols said Monday that Rossi had been barred from teaching for the year because several students were uncomfortable with his presence and asked to be removed from his class.
Yeah. So this is someone who took on the mob, and the mob may have claimed a scalp, but ultimately, hopefully, his words and his courage lives on beyond it. And there was another parent of a student who pulled his daughter out of a school that she had been sent to for 7 years, the Brearley School, another elite private school in New York as well, over similar concerns. And so when you have teachers and parents themselves rebuking these institutions and challenging them, even if they're not followed by a caravan of like-minded parents or other teachers as well, the fact that they're willing to stick their necks out, I think, is tremendously courageous. I mean, it's sad that it's courageous to say that you need to have diversity of thought and that we shouldn't all kowtow to the American version of the Chinese Communist Party line, and that we should reject the anti-cultural revolution that we're currently all experiencing. But nevertheless, it is incredibly courageous. It can cost people their careers. It can make people be shunned in civil society, in their workplaces. I mean, if you're a prominent person in New York working in, you know, any of a number of high powered industries, and you come out and write a letter like this, you have a target on your back for good, probably. And so I'm sure that there are people who quietly off to the side might say, I agree with you, some percentage, hopefully a silent majority. I'm sure it's probably a small silent minority, unfortunately, among fellow parents in many of these institutions. But at the end of the day, the kids suffer as a consequence of this. And both the parent and teacher who both spoke out, and who Barry Weiss recorded their letters at length, they were speaking on behalf of the kids. And at the end of the day, we are going to have a country of credentialed morons if we continue to go with these sort of curriculum. Not only that, but credentialed morons who are devoted to undermining the country under which these institutions flourished in the first place, undermining the values and principles on which the country is based, and ultimately tearing society apart. So I go back to an essay by Nicholas Nassim Taleb that, if everyone hasn't read, The Intellectual Yet Idiot, perfectly describes ultimately where the critical race theorists and all of their spawns who teach the panoply of related so-called disciplines, they're ultimately yielding a country where we're all going to be at each other's throats, impoverished, unsafe, and we're going to loathe the heritage that was bequeathed to us. And so thank God for this professor and also this parent for speaking out. And I think these things went so viral because it did give voice to probably millions of Americans who haven't been able to articulate it or didn't have the platforms to do so.
So I just have two brief things that strike me about this. And the first is that, you know, what is most concerning to me is that this is what our elites are being taught, right? This is the pipeline to, you know, schools like Brearley are the pipeline to the, you know, elite Ivy League universities, which are then the feeders for, you know, corporate America, leading political positions, presidents of the United States. And this is what they're being taught. Again, to riff on what Ben said, to be intellectual idiots and to be intellectual flamethrowers, for better or for worse, right? These are people that want to set the country on fire to a great extent. So I think that is why this remaining vigilant on this front is so important. But I think the flip side of it is this: these are also parents that have the resources, means, and aptitude to pull their kids out when they see what's being done. That same ability is not there for, you know, public school parents who may not even know what's being taught in their schools or have the resources to move or send them, you know, to alternative education or, you know, quit their job and homeschool.
Or even speak up.
And I see this very much. I have, you know, family that teach and work in inner city schools. It is there. This type of critical race theory is there. It is insidious, and there is no one to speak for the kids that are being subject to it. And so that's why I think this is such an important battle for us all to stay engaged in. So those are my two thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, this letter from Andrew Gutman, right, who's pulling his daughter out of Brearley School, this is like high energy material. I mean, you know, if this had been like, if this had been submitted to me as an op-ed in Newsweek, I would have been like, whoa. I mean, this is like pushing the bounds, like even for like me as editor. I mean, maybe you should go to like a conservative publication. I mean, I just want to read a couple of lines from this letter. I mean, it was like an eye-opening stuff when I got Barry's Substack and read it. Andrew says, quote, "I object to mandatory anti-racism training for parents. especially when presented by the rent-seeking charlatans of Pollyanna. A little later, quote, I object to Brearley's vacuous, inappropriate, and fanatical use of words such as equity, diversity, and inclusiveness. I mean, he is not pulling any punches here. This is like full throttle, you know, like Muhammad Ali in the ring, just like going boom, boom, boom with the right jab.
By the
jab.
Way, my favorite line is when he says they're teaching them what to think, not how to think.
Yes.
That to me is critical race theory in totality.
It is. Now, and critical race theory, you know, the point that I'm trying to make here, there are certain issues where the left just kind of comes out full swinging. And like intuitively, I think to myself, huh, they really have to be overstepping on this, right? The transgender stuff with the hormones and the puberty blocking drugs, especially with respect to children, from day one, I saw that and I said to myself, there's no way this is going to fly. I mean, America might be changing, church attendance, synagogue attendance, all of it is kind of dropping for sure, but there's just no way this is going to fly. At the same time, I you know, when this critical race theory stuff started popping out and Chris Rufo started doing his investigative reporting and all that, I similarly kind of said to myself, there's just no way this is going to fly. And I do think I am cautiously optimistic that Emily is right, that this is kind of I don't want to overemphasize Barry Subsack. She's doing great work. We need more people like that, like her and Chris Rufo, who are kind of on this beat. My friend Max Eden, who just joined the American Enterprise Institute, is kind of starting a whole conservative like teacher network to nationally try and combat critical race theory in the classroom. The most important point, though, and then we'll kind of segue to Ben for the final segment of the episode, is what Rachel said, though, is just so true, that like the people we're talking about here, the people who can pull their daughters at a Brearley, you know, this is like this is what Bernie Sanders would call the 1%, right? I mentioned this on a previous podcast episode, but my mom is a public school teacher. She taught fourth grade for most of her career. Now she's doing third grade. She told me that there's like a school district required kind of social justice poetry segment for later this year. And I said to her, I said, like, mom, like, I really want to like review this material. Like, I would like to make like editorial suggestions. I'm not sure if she has the freedom to make said suggestions, but the point is that this is a public school and that, you know, her students primarily in this public school are kind of largely blue collar working class and they don't have a choice. So if anything, all this should just, I think, like get conservatives, Republicans and state legislatures to just double down on things like school choice and vouchers and lots of public policies that now more than ever before have to be the path forward. But speaking of race hucksterism, Ben, what's the latest with our favorite race huckster, Ibram X. Kendi?
Well, I wrote this piece for The Federalist, sort of taking stock of where we are as a country. And the conclusion fell out that essentially we're living in Ibram X. Kendi's America increasingly, that all of our institutions speak in Kendian tongue, and that the consequences of that will ultimately be the erosion of liberty and justice under the guise of quote unquote equity. And there are a few data points that I spoke to before delving into what Ibram X. Kendi believes, because if we're going to live in an anti-racist country, we better know what the ideas are behind anti-racism. So first, the Biden administration on its first day passed an executive order that I'll read just briefly from a bit later, called an executive order on advancing racial equity and support for underserved communities through the federal government. And it calls for affirmatively advancing a racial equity. So I'll get into what that means in just a moment. Recently, of course, many of our viewers likely know that Oakland passed this sort of universal basic income pilot program, but it wasn't universal. It was only for people of color. A leading Boston-based medical institution is piloting a race-based preferential treatment plan for patients there. We obviously know all about the Great Awakening and corporate America and where the media is broadly and beyond, but there are any number of data points that you can pick on a weekly basis that indicate that equity is now in vogue and it has supplanted equality. So what does that mean? Equity, as the anti-racists use it, and that language is conformed to, by the way, as I'll note in a minute, in the first Biden administration executive order on the first day. Equity is essentially a society where people are represented in terms of their group in direct proportion to their group numbers in every aspect of life. And so to achieve equity, the anti-racist says we must implement policies that force essentially this rebalancing of representation in every aspect of life according to one's skin color or other identity, presumably as well. So of course, to get to that equalization or proportionality requires completely running roughshod over liberty and justice in this country. It would destroy the very freedoms and liberties that people of all colors have benefited from. And you are a racist, definitionally, if you oppose anti-racist policy, because as Ibram X. Kendi tells us, people aren't the problem, policies are the problem. And so basically what it says is in every aspect of life where there is inequity, essentially, you need to have policies of equity, which means radically racialist, progressive policies to fix these inequities in every aspect of life. And if you oppose it, you are being a bigot and a racist. So essentially, it's a clever way of using racism or using race as a cudgel to enforce a totalitarian agenda. And Kendi himself says explicitly, he doesn't actually think people can really be persuaded on this. It's all about power, ultimately. And so I appreciate the candor there. And so in this article, I walk through these sort of recent examples showing how the cult of anti-racism has come to dominate across our institutions. And then I say, well, what does Ibram X. Kendi believe about any number of issues? And so he calls for a constitutional amendment, basically calling for a new branch in the Department of Justice that will analyze every policy and essentially say, is this advancing equity or not? If it's not advancing equity, it's obviously a racist policy and it needs to be stricken from the books. This, of course, would erode all standards of freedom whatsoever. But even leaving aside this pipe dream constitutional amendment, but which he's nevertheless shifting an Overton window on, and we'll see where the Biden DOJ itself actually goes in relation to this. He's explicitly anti-assimilationist. He's anti-race neutrality. He's anti-capitalist. And I quote him at length here to back up these positions. He's, of course, against standardized testing. That is, he's against merit because merit is bigoted. He calls standardized testing one of the most pernicious racist tools out there. So I thought it's important to chronicle these ideas, given that we're living in an anti-racist America today. And I'll sort of close by quoting from the Biden administration executive order, which proves that we are truly living in an anti-racist country now. The executive order reads in part, and this is almost cribbing precisely from Kendi, quote, entrenched disparities, and this is in section one, entrenched disparities in our laws and public policies and in our public and private institutions have often denied that equal opportunity to individuals and communities. Our country faces converging economic, health, and climate crises that have exposed and exacerbated inequities, while a historic movement for justice has highlighted the unbearable human costs of systemic racism. Our nation deserves an ambitious whole-of-government equity agenda that matches the scale of the opportunities and challenges that we face. So those very pernicious ideas that we're talking about combating at schools today among our youth at these elite institutions, they've already matriculated down, or they've already sort of percolated down across our elites. And this shows you the consequences of having an education system dominated by radical leftists for decades and decades, is that the policies are already here. We're already talking about a whole of government anti-racist agenda. So God knows what it's going to look like in the next generation of students to the extent they continue to be indoctrinated under this anti-American radical regime. So to sort of balance out the kind of happy note that we had in the last segment, I wonder what thoughts you all have about the idea that we're currently living in an anti-racist country.
Well, just briefly to touch on your whole of government approach, earlier this morning, I was looking at a document from the Federal Trade Commission about equity in artificial intelligence. And I was just thinking, wow, what could go wrong actually here? So I think that, you know, this is, again, the tentacles are everywhere. The groundwork's been laid, and this is a very pernicious ideology that's infecting all of our areas of governance, like down from the federal to the state level into the schools. And I think it's incumbent upon, you know, conservatives really to it's not enough almost to sort of speak out and be courageous, which is a very vital point. But I think our sort of governing structures have to change. Like our policymakers need to say this is not appropriate. And, you know, even at the corporate governance level, to say this is not to be tolerated in a country where, you know, you cannot sustain a self-government when you have no consensus on these points. So we've talked about this before, but I think the stakes are incredibly high for this particular debate.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know that I have a whole lot to add here. You know, intersectionality, critical race theory, this anti-racism notion, this notion that Martin Luther King was wrong because he was not effectively overtly racist against white people. This is just Looney Tunes stuff. And not only is this Looney Tunes stuff, and I kind of type out to our last segment, I think there's going to be, already is, but I think there will only continue to be kind of a visceral kind of backlash against what is overt racism. Let's not mince words here. So-called anti-racism is overt racism. It is also just so anathema to what this country stands for. I query whether anyone other than, you know, conservatives cares about that anymore. But to the extent that we do care, I mean, there is no more fundamentally, quintessentially American creed, of course, than equal justice under the law. The notion that we are all human beings, the notion of equal justice under the law, obviously itself just being a concept that is downstream of Genesis, that we are all kind of made in the image of God. So we really do need to start getting our hands dirty as conservatives and kind of get in there and fight back and fight in the weeds, and not just rhetorically, but kind of get in there. And it's something we talked about, by the way, on previous episodes. I mean, something that I recall saying in one of our previous podcasts was to say, you know, there's so many people who are so focused on kind of the national dialogue. They tune into Fox News or CNN or MSNBC, depending on their political preferences. And all they care about is a national conversation. The most immediate way, really, to kind of make like a tangible impact at a local level is to run for school board. Seriously, to get involved in your local school district and to push back against some of this kind of woke indoctrination that is happening right before us. Because these people, the Ibram X. Kendis of the world, the Robin DiAngelos of the world, They are charlatans. They are intellectual lightweights who don't know what in God's name they are talking about. And there is a visceral disgust that I think is already kind of boiling up on behalf of the American people. But the more that we kind of get in there at a local kind of grassroots level and just make this argument, make the basic kind of bedrock building argument for civilization. You know, there's a famous line that Abraham Lincoln said. I think it was from his very first debate with Stephen Douglas. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, where he famously talks about kind of the importance of public sentiment, how with public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without public sentiment, nothing can succeed, paraphrasing. That should be, I think, kind of our guiding light on this issue. I think the American people still, despite all the shifts that have happened that all the demographers have talked about, still to their core and a visceral level oppose this stuff. We just have to get in there and continue to make the case.
Oh, absolutely. And that is such an important aspect of this. This is not, then that's also an optimistic aspect of this. I mean, talk about intellectual idiots. Ibram X. Kendi is the poster child of intellectual idiocy. So much of far leftism and radical leftism has calcified in the echo chamber that is higher education in America for decades, to the point where it hasn't had to withstand any challenges. And the rest of the country wasn't really watching as that was happening, but conservatives were. And conservatives were saying, this is extremely dangerous. This is going to hit the so-called real world and change it. And you should be worried about that. And lo and behold, that happened. And the media had, you know, ignored the pleas of conservatives for so long because they're obviously not inclined to take conservatives seriously. And they haven't been for a really long time. But we are now reaping the consequences of that lack of skepticism and of that lack of interest, because the intellectual idiocy of Ibram X. Kendi, as Ben lays out in his Federalist piece, which is a really good recapping of all of the things you need to know about Ibram X. Kendi, he comes down on this very clear and explicit binary formulation. You are racist or anti-racist. There is nothing in between. People don't just make occasionally insensitive remarks without knowing or out of ignorance. They fundamentally fall into those two categories. And that means, again, as Josh mentioned, these sort of conversations about like Martin Luther King and segregated dorms, which are back on our campuses. That is just plain racism. And the intellectual idiots who have this calcified and totally unchallenged ideology can jibber jabber about that as much as they want, and they will continue to do so, but it just does not comport with basic logic. And people have an ability to actually understand basic logic. And the other optimistic note, I'm weirdly optimistic today again, I think it's because of the beautiful weather, or maybe it is genuinely because of the merits of these topics. Another optimistic point to end all of this on is that something really good exists in this American division over the expansion of the definition of racism that the left is trying very hard to get away with. What is the optimistic? What is the good in that? It's because racism is incredibly stigmatized culturally and socially in the United States of America, as it should be, because a heck of a lot of blood, sweat, and tears was spilled to get to the point that we're at today. And the Ibram X. Kendis of the world just want to drag drag us back with their ideologies that haven't undergone the sufficient challenges that they should be getting in higher education. It's really sad, but it is great that in this country, people feel so offended to be called racist. Because nobody wants to be a racist, because we abhor racism in this country, because it is socially stigmatized. And so that, again, it's optimistic. I mean, it does show that there has been a lot of progress. And so there's another silver lining that we can at least hold on to for the time being.
Yeah, let me just say, Emily hits the nail on the head by talking about how the anti-racist worldview of you're either an anti-racist, i.e. a progressive totalitarian, or a racist if you reject any element of the radically progressive racialist totalitarian agenda, perfectly describes how this is sort of more tactical than philosophical at the end of the day. And it's worth noting, let me quote from Kendi here, briefly. He says, the only remedy to racist discrimination is anti-racist discrimination. The only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. The only remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination. And so he's explicitly calling for tearing the country apart and essentially a resegregation on the basis of his ideology. Yeah, of course, segregated dorms, segregated graduation ceremonies, and on and on. It is a recipe for racial strife to be exploited by the people like Kendi, who essentially have created a great grift here, and then the politicians who pit us against each other and try to tear us apart as a divide and conquer strategy to ultimately impose more regressive policies on us and usurp more power over our lives. And so I think it's critical to note, first of all, what the ends are of these policies. And like I mentioned, you know, Kendi describes this Department of Anti-Racism that is to pre-clear literally every policy at every level, I'm quoting him again, to ensure they won't yield racial inequity, investigate private racist policies when racial inequity surfaces, and monitor public officials for expressions of racist ideas. So all of this comes down to, it's a totalitarian power grab under the guise of virtue and morality and justice. It's not about any of those things. It's about vengeance and power. And so when we talk about these ideologies, we obviously have to debunk them and destroy them, and they ought to be, and they're very easy to wreck intellectually. But we also need to be clear about what the stakes ultimately are and what the aims ultimately are, and make it very clear when we're describing these policies that this isn't an even-handed intellectual debate. It's one side trying to have total power, essentially. And so what are you going to do in the face of that power? And I think Josh definitely has explained some ways in which we as individuals can go about combating it, but we have to be engaged, because in the absence of being engaged here, these radical ideas will win the day. And that's what we need to fight against every single day of our lives in whatever way we can, putting our skills, interests, and capabilities to their highest and best use in defense of this country.
Yeah, so let's go around the room for some closing thoughts here. Anyone kind of want to get us started? We're talking a lot about kind of power dynamics, seems to be the theme of this episode. Anyone have any kind of thoughts that kind of weave together all the themes that we've discussed today?
Well, I can jump in and just say I started my career in higher education at Young America's Foundation, analyzing and trying to keep higher education in check. And at the time, it was sort of unthinkable to me that a lot of the stuff would go mainstream so quickly. But I also think it was unthinkable to me that there would be people courageous and brave enough to push back in mass and in really big platforms against it so quickly as well. So it's risen quickly, but the backlash seems to be rising quickly. And at the heart of so many of our issues is, of course, this very divisive and pernicious ideology of cultural leftism that divides us on very, very, very false logic and false grounds. So I am heartened, really, to see people respond and to see the letters that Barry has published on her Substack. Gives me hope. And so I'm very, very hopeful going forward, actually, that there's a sort of emperor has no clothes situation unfolding right before our eyes. People are seeing it and calling it out. And that can only withstand, that can only last for so long, I think, despite the fact that right now it is currently espoused by just about every major institution in this country. We still roughly have a bottom-up system. And so that's something to be hopeful about.
Yeah, it strikes me, you know, a lot on these episodes, but particularly today, you know, we aren't really debating the merits of policy or bills or legislation. We are really talking about existential threats to kind of the country as a whole and to our way of life. And I think broadly speaking, you know, we call this the NatCon squad and national conservatism. I think oftentimes that's the dividing line between sort of this younger generation of conservatives and the traditional old right, which simply says, well, these are fads. You know, there's nothing we can do. These six policies say that we don't intervene in the market, you know, or, you know, we can't take steps to tell public schools what to do or what to say. And I think that that's a dividing line between myself in particular, who thinks, no, we liberty requires vigilance, and our way of life as conservatives deserves to be protected. And a limited government, that is his primary function of a limited government, is to maintain and provide for the structures that we know work based on, you know, thousands of years of tradition. It's not these, like, you know, ossified policy prescriptions. It's a worldview and a way of life that is worth defending. And I think that's where, you know, I sit on the term, national conservative, someone who says we must act in these circumstances to preserve what is precious and valuable and good. And it is possible to know what those good things are and act in their defense. And, you know, I think that's why so much of what we talk about circles around the existential, because it really is, I think, where we are right now. You know, a lot of times when I talk to older conservatives, they say, well, the pendulum always swings and it'll swing back at some point. Well, that may be true, but how many heads is it going to take off in the interim? I'm just not comfortable sitting back and saying, oh, eventually it'll come to full circle. No, you need, liberty requires vigilance, and that many times requires action from our policies and also from our lawmakers. So that just is my final thought for today, based on the themes that we talked about.
So a firm endorse on all of that. I will only add, in the particular case here of core packing and the course and all that, because it's kind of my area of expertise to the extent I have one. Look, an independent judiciary, a judiciary that was not afraid to go out there and proclaim justice, that was not afraid to go out there and exercise its independent discernment as it pertains to litigants to a particular lawsuit, that has a very, 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 very long tradition in our pedigree, going back hundreds and hundreds of years in the English common law. You know, our common law inheritance is obviously one of kind of the great features upon which the American Republic was first built. The development of the common law and the development of our constitutional order, especially in kind of those more fractious early decades after the founding, would not have been possible if the judiciary had not been able to exercise independent judgment. The current court packing plan from the Democrats, you know, we'll see what Joe Biden does with this commission, but the mere fact that he's proposing it, it should itself be highly disquieting. We'll see what happens there, but it does tell you a lot, not just about how little they care for norms, customs, traditions, all that, we know that, but it talks about how they view just power grabs in general and how willing they are to kind of use every tool at their disposal to take, in this case, the court over. And what I am going to be looking for very carefully, speaking personally, is I'm going to look to see how Republicans and conservatives respond to this. If they change their talking points at all as pertains to constitutional interpretation, judicial politics, judicial nominations, the role of the court, any of that. The left is viewing this as a transparently political institution. To them, the court is no different than the legislature. It is no different than anything else. I am not necessarily saying that conservatives should adopt that, but we do have to be a little less starry-eyed and a little more pragmatic and realistic about what is going on in the terms of the court, in terms of judicial nomination battles in particular. And I really hope that that actually affects Republicans moving forward. But we are way out of time at this point. So on behalf of Rachel, Emily, and Ben, I'm Josh Hammer. We'll see you at the next NatCon Squad.